Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show. We're on.
I hope we're on. Hi, everyone. This is the Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul. And that guy over there is Dan. Hi, Dan.
Yes.
We're having some technical
issues.
Welcome
to Wandering DMs on a slightly technically challenged day.
Okay, so I sure hope you're all seeing us. I'm not 100% sure how to check it.
So if anybody watching, like, David, Brian, and or Fred, can see us and, wants to put a comment whether you see us or not, that would be,
awesome. David Heron tells us it's working.
Woo-hoo! Oh, great. Okay, great. Thank you, David. Wonderful.
All right, let's start again, shall we?
David, did you see anything? Did we get anything out before, or should we just start from the top?
I think we should start from the top. I suspect
okay,
none of it
right.
was working. I saw those comments from our listeners on the chat. Thank you guys so much on the chat for letting us know, because Dan and I would have just sat here talking. So from the top. Dan,
great.
Introduce us. What's our topic for today?
Great. Yes, I'm Dan. And today we're trying to talk about hex crawls. Old school D&D in the wilderness. The DM can't predict where the players are going. And really anything is possible. Anything can happen. Hex crawls.
Awesome. I would like very quickly to credit the creator of the lovely photograph you all see behind me. Was taken by Doug Rogers at the Advance the Colors convention. I thought a gorgeous shot of some hexes. So thank you, Doug Rogers. So, hex crawls. Dan, you and I have a lot of different, experiences with hex crawls. I thought maybe we could quickly roll through them, just sort of spit them out, what the technical, what our experience is playing or running hex crawls, and then we can dive into what we thought worked or didn't work in our hex crawls.
Yeah, so it sounds like you had an early experience at Gen Con around 2010.
I did. So I played in a game that in 2010 it was run in OD&D. At that time, not a lot of people were running OD&D, so I was very excited to go play in it. The guy was running it as a very by the book hex crawl. He was using, I think, the Wilderlands maps from Judges Guild and probably a lot of random tables from that same setting. And really just mechanically walked us through it. You know, you move into this hex, roll randomly to see what happens. Okay, play that out. And frankly, my experience was it was one of the most boring games I'd ever played. By the time the 4 hours were up, I eagerly said, oh, well, guys, I got to go. Even though a couple of them said, oh, we could keep playing. It could keep going. And I said, no, thanks. how about you?
Paul is always very diplomatic, so that's about as harsh as you're going to see Paul at a convention usually.
I have some friends who have exited far less graciously from convention games, and I admire them for that. I can't do it.
So yeah, it was a couple like a year or two later, and Paul and I have an annual event with a whole bunch of friends, as we call it, a little mini convention with maybe as many as 30 friends for the weekend. And a year or two after that, I actually was looking at original D&D, at the original Wilderness rules that are baked into the DM's guide part of OD&D, and was like, I have never seen these get used as they're written. And I kind of wanted to run an experiment of exactly what would happen if I tried to run it as close as I could to these rules as possible. So I came into our convention. I had a session using the original outdoor survival Avalon Hill game map, which is actually part of the required materials listed in original D&D, and I call this session outdoor spoliation, is what I tend to call it. And I came in with the least amount of preparation I've ever had for any game in my life, and I was completely paranoid with one single page of handwritten notes that this clearly couldn't possibly be successful, and it turned into possibly the single biggest hit of running games that I've ever had. And people really enjoyed it, and it was a lot of pressure on me to improvise because literally anything could happen. And there's kind of been a large demand for me to keep running sessions of that from year to year. We get enormous mob of people in the sessions, like 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 people at the table. And it's a lot of excitement, and there's a lot of energy in the room. And I never would have get. I'm still perplexed. I do not understand what. I still don't understand why that game is such a big hit, but it really is. And I come in and I'm sweating bullets. And sometimes I don't know if people are just enthusiastic at seeing me freak out at handling all the crazy stuff that's happening, because I never know what's going to happen when we start.
So I've been playing in those games year after year, and I can tell you that they are really a heck of a lot of fun. Dan adds a little extra complexity to it every year. He's got a set of pre-gen characters that he brings, and many of us who have gone year after year demand to play the same characters so that we get that weird sense of continuity. I recall a specific time once where the character that I have sort of laid claim to at the end of one game had become gayest by an evil sorceress. And at the beginning of the next year, he was not in the list of available characters to play, and I was irate. And by the end of the session, we of course naturally made the whole session about finding him. I say we made it, right? Dan put it as one potential thing that could happen, and we went searching for that lost character. And I think it was one of the most fun games I've played in. So tons of fun.
That was great. And so I keep doing that, and I have a blast doing it, and we have an enormous amount of people. And you've tried to run some games like that in a bunch of different ways.
Real quick, I want to address, Brian has asked about whether or not he should give his players a blank hex map or put the board in front of the players. Brian, we're definitely going to talk about that. And in fact, we've tried a variety of different things. So in fact, actually, maybe that's a great segue for me to give you a couple other experiences I have in running hex crawls.
Yeah.
And we'll get to Brian's question, I promise. I ran a long-running campaign for many years, and my style of game, I've never been one for, like, big mega dungeons. Those are fun. I've run some in the past, and I've played some, but I always prefer, like, a large, sprawling wilderness with many smaller dungeons sprinkled throughout, and then safe places as well, towns, villages, castles, where the players can go, which should sound a lot to you like what you see when you look at that outdoor survival board. So I usually draw a big wilderness map, and I sprinkle my content throughout. And when my players are exploring it, they don't necessarily know they're on a hex crawl. I have a hex map behind the screen, and I'm tracking where they go, and I'm rolling to see if they get lost, and I'm rolling for random encounters. But they have a vague-ish map and kind of know points of where they're going, and if they wanted to like get hex paper out and draw on that hex paper, they could, but that's up to them. But I never really like pushed it and said, this is a hex crawl. We're doing a hex crawl now. And then my other big experience is I did once after playing in many of Dan's outdoor spoliation games, ran a convention game where I said, I want to see if I can find a middle ground between those two things. So I ran a game where the players, had an outdoor area that they wanted to explore. They had a vague map again, like not a hex map, but a vague map with a couple of details on it they wanted to find. But then I also had a large hex map that I put on the table in front of them with the many of the hexes obscured, and through play we revealed what was in those hexes.
Do you want to I think you have a...
Let's take a look. Yes, awesome. Yes.
So, what would that look like in practice?
It looks something like this. So here it is. This is just a little magnetic whiteboard I bought at Staples. The hex map is just printed out on some nice heavy cardstock and kind of held in place with these magnets. The players arrived via ship, so we have a little ship here that they could move around the coast. I should show you. And at the beginning, they were given this map. Here's the map that they were given. As you can see, it's sort of the right shape, and it's got some details on it, but not a lot. You can sort of see where there's some rivers that enter in. There's some text here that hint at things. For example, there's one thing over here. It says, I'm going to move this so I can read it. Lord Istris, breeder of the finest horses. that was meant to be a little hint of like, oh, maybe the players could go over there if they want to get horses to move around the land faster. So then they moved around turn by turn, and these are just little magnets. Basically, I took a magnetic business card, which you can also buy at Staples, and I stuck some white paper to it and cut out these hex shapes. So as the players moved around and explored, I would reveal hexes, like so. And I was prepared for a variety of... Usually, I would definitely reveal the hex they moved into. Maybe if they moved into a mountain hex, they have a little height, so I would reveal a further... Oh, you can see down into this valley. Here you go. If the players were clever and came up with something like, I cast a fly spell and fly straight up so I can see further, I was prepared for that kind of stuff. But that's the gist. That's what we did. I'm going to come back.
And I've been a player in that game, and that was great. It worked super well. Yeah, I think I recall being terrified at several circumstances, and it worked very well. And now I am kicking myself for not getting the horses.
That said, the funny thing about that is I also had pages of handouts of, because this is all based on actually output of my campaign. So I had tons of stuff, and I had pages of background, which I handed to the players, and I said, here's a bunch of information you know about this location. You don't have to read any of this, but for those who like that sort of thing, here you go. Yeah. One of the players super dug into it and totally knew the secret hidden answer to the Sphinx's riddle as a result, and worked you guys around out of an encounter with a Sphinx by outsmarting it.
Right. Yes. There was a moment where we're like, oh God, there's a freaking riddle, and whoever that was, you're like, here it is. You're like, oh, well, that was great. that was good play, everybody.
Yep. But I was prepared for you guys to fight the Sphinx or whatever. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's nothing to do with crawling hexes. So let's talk about like the big question, right? Is do you have the board in front of the players? Do you reveal the hexes or not? I know, Dan, I bring up my weird covered-up hexes because, of course, when you run outdoor spoliation, the board's right in front of us the whole time.
Yeah, so Brian's question about that is absolutely one of the things I want to talk about, because that was one of the big discoveries of my little D&D science experiment, is on the one hand, I kind of just initially just wanted people to see the outdoor survival map, and just how pretty it is, actually. There you go. So those of us who've used it, you know, it really has all kinds of interesting strategic points of interest to the layout. You know, maybe not totally a realistic piece of geography, but all kinds of interesting, you know, bottlenecks and decisions to be made if you're traveling around it. And so I kind of wanted people to see it and interact with it. Partly just me being lazy. It's like, here's the outdoor survival map. It's on the table. That's what I've done for you. I haven't done Paul's more elaborate set of just like, here's an existing board game and you're looking at it.
But that said, Dan, I want to point out this picture is a picture of your actual board, which has been lovely cleaned up thanks to Isabel. Thank you so much, Isabel, for doing that. But I want to point out, like, there's some writing on there, right? You've written some notes. It looks like I can see some Roman numerals here and there. You want to talk a little bit about what that's about?
Right. So in the original outdoor survival game, where you're some kind of lost explorer or hiker, there's a bunch of ponds there, those little dark blobs, where you can get water, which is probably the single most important thing in that game, actually. And you can see kind of around right on the edge and around the center, there are these cabins where you can get extra food in some versions. And so in the original D&D rules, Gygax said, use the ponds as castles and use the cabins as towns. And so in order to identify those, I put these little Roman numerals with a wax pencil so I could key to particular things. So that is my handwriting there next to them. I do adjust that. So in our outdoor spoliation games, I change it so the ponds become caves with random monsters and the cabins are the only castles. So that's the one major change I make with it, kind of to work in some extra monster variety. Yeah.
I really like that. For us in play, those caves become real goal points, right? Because because it's a 4-hour convention game, right, you could see in a campaign where those caves would become elaborate underground, you know, on graph paper exploration. But Dan, for the sake of it being a convention game, whittles that down to just like a quick, okay, here's a couple of caves, here's an encounter fight, but there's always treasure, right? Like, unlike the random, there's usually treasure. There's often treasure. Can I say that?
Yeah.
There's often treasure, right? More so than, say, a random monster you meet in the woods as you travel across from point A to point B. So those become, as we are, as players, sort of setting our goals and saying, well, we're going to go from here to here, and we're going to stop at this cave and this cave along the way. We think, great, that's how we're going to get some treasure.
Right. And that's right in the book. I mean, the original D&D rules say, you know, have this is the monster in its lair percentage chance, and you only get treasure if they're in the lair. So I've got the lairs, you know, preset. The interesting thing is, you know, actually, if I were completely redo it, Paul, I might actually switch back. I did an analysis a while ago about like how common castles were in Dark Ages England. And the funny thing is that having all the pawns be castles is actually a somewhat better representation of that.
Well, I feel like maybe we perhaps surprise you in the first one by assaulting a castle? Was that something you expected us to do?
Because this is a really good point, because now I'm accustomed to it. Yeah. Now I'm accustomed that I'm going to have to handle at least 3 castle assaults per 4-hour session. You know, and yes, you're right. The first time I was like, well, they're not going to attack a castle. That's ridiculous.
Right. Well, because historically it's ridiculous to attack a castle. But then when you consider, but I can fly and I can shoot fireballs. Okay, maybe you can assault a castle.
And we've charmed a dragon and everything else. And we also got 100 bandits to surrender to our cause.
So
the players. So nowadays, so that's the main thing when I'm running this game, is that I have to go in expecting to narratively improvise a castle assault between my 20 bloodthirsty PCs, a bunch of people they've charmed, and 300 people in the castle. And it's the single craziest run a game situation I've ever had. And but if we have a session where the players don't get to sack a castle, I'm actually in some amount of trouble at the convention.
Yeah. It's you know, honestly, I think that's why these games are so successful. That it really is that extreme of the D&D concept of you can do anything. Literally, we can do anything. And I think you know, we delight in surprising you. I remember a time when somebody read a cursed scroll which teleported us to a random position on the map, and we ended up in the middle of a desert, and we thought for sure we were all going to die. And one of the clever players had happened to have a wall of ice spell, so he quickly cast that so that we could catch the melting ice so that we wouldn't die of thirst.
That was actually one of my favorite moments from that, is that because I actually kind of thought that I was, because the curse came in right when you defeated a particular lair and get an enormous amount of money. And I was so happy to curse you to the other side of the map and be like, all right, I think I managed to kill them using just supply rules, because you didn't have your horses and supplies with them. And I was like, great. And the wall of ice tactic came up, and I was like, is that legit? I'm like, yeah, I gotta say yes to that. I can't say no to that. That was really smart.
That was a great move. Now let's talk a little bit about.
So I might put more. If I were to redo it, I might put more castles. I might switch closer to the book and actually have more opportunities for that, and maybe have some like monster lairs that are hidden and not visible on the map, maybe.
Yeah, and we've had a variety of experiences at those castles. I want to point out, like, yes, we sack castles for sure, but sometimes. We've had moral debates about whether the person deserved to be sacked. We've met nice people at castles. I think we had a joust once with one of the castle owners.
Several times.
So I think
recently I've heard, if anyone challenges us to a joust again, just kill that guy is what I've heard from somebody fairly recently.
It turns out that unless you're Dan, and have very carefully analyzed the OD&D jousting rules, really it feels very random and unlikely to win. But that's the jousting rules. I want to go back to, why are we so delighted by these games? versus why I had such a terrible, terrible time at that first game back at Gen Con. What do you think the difference is?
So the number one thing that I added to the original D&D rules is a goal. Mm-hmm. And so particularly in these tournament games, I do feel that the players need to have some kind of are you winning or are you not measurement. You can't literally just go in and go just do whatever you want and it's a random bunch of stuff. So I do come in and like what I do with outdoor spoliation is you are one level away from becoming barons. And if you can get whatever it is, 100,000 gold pieces, you'll have enough experience, you'll become barons and we'll declare you winners. And I think with a couple other things along the way to add to that goal. And so, yeah, the players are real focused on we get to be barons. And there's a lot of excitement and energy around, are we getting close to that money number to be declared winners at the end?
Now I feel like, I prefer not only one goal, but in fact, a couple of orthogonal goals. I knew I did that in my Dorantheon Bones game, where I had the similar goal of, yep, you want this much money. That's what it's going to cost for. I think they had hired their boat and they wanted to own it. They wanted to buy it. So like, here's how much the boat costs. You need to find this much money on the island. But then also, there was a secondary goal. I think of this island in this campaign world, this island is inhabited by the undead remains of an ancient civilization, and where the players come from, the scholars are very interested in that. And so there's this, that's in fact the reference of Dorantheon's Bones, find Dorantheon's Bones. And any other information you can find about his reign from many hundreds and thousands of years ago. And so I think that's nice, like to give the players a little menu of here's two or three things that you can do. What do you guys want to do?
And I think that both of us, Paul, you and I have both worked that more into our tournament convention games.
Yeah.
In the last couple of years. And so my other games, even if I'm running like a classic module like Hall, the Fire Giant King, I give a menu. It can be as simple as just like four things. You want information about the assaults. You want money. You want to defeat giants and maybe a fourth thing. And then as a college professor, I can give you an A, B, C, or D grade for how many of those points, how many of those goal points you picked up. And it really focuses the play and kind of tells everybody at the end whether you've done really well or you've got your ass kicked.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's super important for convention games. I will point out, when I was running my quasi-hex crawl parts of my campaign, in those cases, often the point of that wasn't necessarily to be this experience in of itself, right? Usually it was just simply about the players want to get from here to there, and I want the world to feel alive to them, so we're actually going to have them travel, and I'm going to see what happens to them along the way. And that's not just filler, right? That's a lot of times things happened in there where I'd have to write down some notes and go, well, that's interesting. I guess this thing is in my world now. Let me write that down for later.
Yes.
So that's super important. But I would say there are still goals in that case. But in that case, the goals totally came from the players, right? They knew we have these personal goals that we've established over weeks of play of, well, we want to get to this dungeon to find this thing, or I want to get to this place or get this much money so I can level up, so I can do this other thing. So they're already bringing those goals with them into the hex crawl part of the game.
Right. And what I'm finding in my campaign is that the players tend to be sticking a little bit closer to the roads and trails, like you're saying. Like, mm-hmm. They want to get from one place to another, and so there does tend to be a little bit more, we're sticking to the roads. And that changes a little bit how the rules of, like, being lost and move rates and encounters interacts a little bit. And then what I'm finding with the wandering monsters is a monster shows up, and maybe you make that percent in lair chance, and now you know that hex has a lair of goblins or something like that. Or what I'm finding a lot is they encounter some neutral woodsmen or elves, and they negotiate and they go, well, where is your home? Where do these elves live? Mm-hmm. And then kind of on the fly, I have to make up, okay, well, that's a good point. Apparently the elves live somewhere, and I got to pick where that is. And so as time goes on, those wandering encounters actually wind up populating my campaign world more and more. And every hex winds up with somebody living in it if you play long enough, which I didn't expect. And this is even if the players are sticking to the roads all the time.
Yep. So, great. Let's, I want to keep us on track here. Let's talk about getting lost.
So a little bit of history, right? So here's my history part.
Excellent.
The Avalon Hill outdoor survival game predates D&D, beautiful map, written by a guy named Jim Dunnigan. He was the head of SBI later on, has over 300 war games to his name. I saw him speaking at age 75 this fall. Original D&D has outdoor survival as a required component of materials. And basically all the D&D wilderness travel rules are directly just lifted from outdoor survival originally. And one of them is the lost rule. And in one thing that is probably the thing that irritates me the most is in outdoor survival, the board game, if you fail a chance to get lost, which is actually incredibly common, the rule is that you're required to travel in a straight line for that day for your maximum distance. You take off, straight line, you're not allowed to make navigational changes. You're just in a straight line, you wind up someplace you didn't want to. That carries through directly to original D&D. You make a lost rule and you're required to just travel in a straight line. I think in AD&D, advanced D&D, they switch that. So what happens is just the orientation of the whole map changes and you're permanently being given faulty directions until you can correct that. Now when I look at apparently experiments or real life data, apparently that's totally not what happens. If you get lost, you wind up traveling in a circle and you wind up not actually going anywhere at all. So in my, when I run my games, that irritates me so much that I switch it. If you get lost, you're circling around that hex for a day and you basically lose a day. The original rule, and you're seeing some rules someone wrote very recently, carries on that tradition really from outdoor survival, that you're going off in an unintended direction for a distance. What do you, so I switch that out and just have you basically not make any movement because you're circling.
So mechanically,
some experiments have shown.
Mechanically, how do you do it, right? So it's the start of a day. The players say, great, we're going to travel from this point to this point along these hexes. What happens next?
Yeah, there's a D6 roll. In original D&D, it's depending on the terrain. Mm-hmm. If you're in clear, it's only a 1 in 6 chance. If you're in mountains, it's 3 in 6 chance you get lost.
Do you roll that or do the players?
Good question. I do, currently. Okay.
And do you roll it in the open or privately?
I do. And as usual, I tell them what the situation
Darn.
Is. So for me, it's in a fistful. I actually have 3 dice, one for the wandering encounter, one for weather, and one if they get lost. So I throw 3 dice in a bin, and I say, basically, if these come up higher, it's worse for you. And they all crouch over to see how bad it gets.
Right, okay, but they don't necessarily know which die is lost and which die is encounters.
I'll tell them, and some people, some remember and some don't. The particular color is the lost die.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I find that, I would think that, especially when you've got the board in front of you, that getting lost and then moving them in a different direction than where they tended to go just feels weird, I would think. I can't remember exactly how I did it for Geranthian's Bones, but I'm going to really quickly switch here to my side camera here just to show folks. When I was running my campaign, you can see here, this is the map that my players had for campaign play. Originally, I drew this map. Again, it just has important points. The distances are maybe wrong, and I told them, maps are not great in this time period. And you can see some pencil marks on there that they made as they explored around and whatnot. So they took some notes on this map, but they never, no one ever bothered to sit down and draw their own map. I was prepared for them to do so, but nobody decided to do that. Gotcha. Meanwhile, behind the screen, here's what I had. Here's my binder, and there's the actual, hex map. And this is just a detail of what's in here. I think if we look at these two, you can see sort of, here's Bridgefair and here's Restenford. That's the distance here along this section of hexes. So I have many pages of very detailed hexes to go with this kind of very vague map. That's something I really like to do to the players, is give them vague maps and tell them how terrible cartography is in that time period, because it's amusing. The reason I bring that up is I find that system, it's much easier to do lost rolls, because when I roll behind the screen and I determine they're lost, I just move them into not the hex they were expecting. I may start pushing them in a slightly different direction than where they think they're going, and I'll continue to describe, and eventually they'll be like, oh, wait a minute, we're much further north than we're supposed to be. We're, oh, geez, I see that volcano in the horizon. How do we get way up here? And so it feels like being lost. Whereas I think, like, if you just have the map in front of you and you roll a die and then you push them to the wrong hex, they're going to go, well, that's annoying, and then immediately correct.
Yeah, so is your intention, so when the effect of that for you, do you keep them, like, disoriented in the wrong direction for an extended period, or...
I move them... It's been a long time since I played this,
right.
But I feel like what I would do is they would say they're going north, and I would maybe move them northeast or slightly differently from where they expected. Now, then I would just continue to listen to them, and they would say, okay, we're going to continue north, and at that point, they're offset, or possibly I just keep pushing them in the wrong direction and think, oh, they've misoriented. And I'm just keeping tabs of which hex they're in and describing that hex to them, and eventually they'll reach some landmark and realize that they've screwed up.
Yeah, my instinct is, and if you're in the D&D wilderness, like the way the original rules are written, you have to be fairly high level. So if you're going to survive encounters with 300 goblins or 300 bandits or possibly 1d4 Balrogs just wandering around on a daily basis, you have to be fairly high level. And my instinct, I feel like, is somebody there has to have enough outdoor skills that they're going to realize at the end of the day where they are. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that, at least for me, it's a synthesis of you're not going to be lost. You're not going to not know where you are for days and days at a time. You're going to know by the end of the day when you can take a sight, when the sun comes behind the clouds or something like that, with the map visible. You're right. I don't keep them in the dark more than a single day or a single turn.
Now the reason this topic, the topic of hex crawls, came up in general is I've been listening to this podcast, Fear of a Black Dragon, and in their second half of their Carcosa review, they went deep on hex crawls. And one thing they brought up, which I want to reiterate here just because it's interesting, and I don't think either of us have ever done this, one thing that they came up with that they liked is to add an NPC who is a guide, or like a Sherpa, right? So they have an NPC who's with the party, who knows the lay of the land, right? And they use that to talk to the players. They ostensibly make that character totally disinterested in where are we going? Oh, we're going to north? All right, well, we're going to have to go around that big mountain. Oh, we're going to go south. Well, maybe you don't want to go due south because that forest is infested with horrible goblins. Like, maybe we should go around. But, you know, would sort of, you know, verbally give the players information about where they are or how to get, you know, sort of the details of how to get to a place, but just didn't really care, didn't care where the party went. What do you think about incorporating that kind of NPC?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I have, I've had at least one guide in my campaign recently where the players have the option. You can pay money and hire this guide, and at least in this particular area, it will wipe out any chance of lost and also avoid encounters. And so that was, you know, in the menu of options. And I think flavor-wise, it's a great idea. In some ways, I wish I could work it in more, actually, because, actually on my recent trip to Peru, more Peru videos coming next Sunday, actually in 1 week, on this channel, so stay tuned. That was actually an important part of how Machu Picchu was rediscovered about a century actually ago. Is you needed local guides to find the hidden places actually. So in reality, it's incredibly important to get a local guide, and I can see a lot of reasons for working that in actually. For me, what I've done is I've made it a menu item to possibly. Make it so you don't get lost in a particular place.
It strikes me as an interesting way of narrating the results of being lost, of sort of saying, okay, so they went the wrong direction. whatever, I move them in the wrong place, and then immediately say, and your guide turns to you and says, oh no, we've gone the wrong way. Right? I recognize this place.
Right.
We've made a mistake we're going to have to correct. Right. And it just seems an amusing way to give that information to the players in the voice of this NPC, rather than just telling the players, boink, here you are, in the wrong hex.
Right.
I should, so, you know, before I forget, I should address Brian's original question, because to be clear, I don't run the maps the same way that Paul does. I do have the hex map out in front of everybody, and one of the most important discoveries in that game is how engaged all the players get when the map is physically in front of all of them. And so even with 9 or 10 players, what we discovered with outdoor spoliation is everybody can see it, it's very visible, and everybody can have an opinion about we should move here first and then move there. No, wait, it would be better if we went through this pass and went through here. So having the map physically available for everybody makes the whole thing very team-oriented, very, very strategic. And as a lesson, I've tried to work that more into my other D&D games, of having opportunities to give a dungeon map where people have a reason to make choices about one direction or the other.
Awesome.
So I've tried to work that more into my games. And one of my notes, like, I think in late era D&D, a lot of adventures would come with an artistic, a very interesting map with no hexes. But that doesn't actually support, in my opinion, that doesn't support any actual strategic gameplay point. So I tend to get really irritated, actually, at these artistic maps with no hexes, because to me, that has to be a playable, you know, player interaction element. And so Paul just told me about his hybrid strategy right before this live cast started. And I was like, oh, wait, what? Really? Oh, okay. That's actually a good point. So it's an interesting hybrid of you giving the players kind of an in-game sketchy map and you using a hex map. Yeah. That's not something I would do, but
right.
That's
to be clear,
that's
you're talking about the approach. What I did in campaign play where I had the hex map and they just
right.
had just worse. The funny thing is, I when I started that, I was totally prepared for, like, they'll realize it's hexes and ask for hex paper, and then they'll start,
gotcha.
Like, it'll be just like dungeon crawling, where they have graph paper, right. and they're drawing what they do. Now, that never
right.
happened. Like, just organically
right.
through play, it never happened. And ultimately, I kind of liked it, right? I don't know that I would do it for convention play, but
okay,
I liked
yeah.
it for campaign play.
In my campaign, my players have a map of the region. That not initially, but they went hunting in the city library, and I just handed over a slightly simplified a hex map of the campaign area.
Yeah.
So they actually do have a hex map
okay,
now.
Okay. I mean, I love any case of giving the players an incomplete or poor map. I think that's super fun. It's here's a little bit of information, but not a lot. Now it could go
yeah.
the way that I just showed you, where I have like this kind of vague map with points, and probably the distances are wrong. I've also seen cases like. Oh, there's a great Judges Guild module about a haunted house called something name I can't remember. I think you played in it, Dan. But
talking one, Tegel Manor.
It's not Tegel Manor. It's the other
okay.
one.
Oh, okay.
The other one. But the way I play that is I give them a piece of graph paper with the outline of the map drawn. Yep, Brian says Tegel Manor. It's not Tegel Manor.
I agree with Brian. It sounds like Tegel Manor.
It's not Tegel Manor. I'm gonna find
it. Sounds like Tegel Manor to me.
Yep. I'm gonna find it. But hopefully before
the interesting thing is my copy of Tegel Manor came with a pre-made player handout, like you're describing. Came with a pre-made
yeah.
outline of the manor to hand off to the players. So I agree with your excellent idea for Tegel Manor.
House on Hangman's Hill was the name. Quick
oh, right.
search
yeah.
gave it to me. House
right.
on Hangman's Hill. There you
right.
go. Okay, real quick, I want to catch up with some comments. There have been some great comments in our chat. Brian asked how you approach stocking hexes. What portion of hexes do you like to be empty unless a wandering monster is rolled? I will say on my Duranthian Bones game, which, I don't know, it's got to have a couple hundred hexes on it, I'm guessing. Maybe 100
yeah.
hexes. I think I stocked about 12. How about you, Dan?
Yeah, I would say about the same thing in my campaign area. I've got some towns. I have a bunch. I have about 12 castles, and I have maybe 3 or 4 ruins. And the interesting thing that is, as time goes on, the wandering monster rules wind up populating more of the area as you play more. So it actually has this self-generating quality that the original rules will start filling it in for you.
Yep, agreed with that.
David Heron there has the comment about using the lost rule as a time penalty rather than distance. That's exactly what I do. It's pretty close to just a lost turn. It's pretty close to a board game with you lose a turn, which actually is what you find in original outdoor survival. There's an encounter map, and there's an encounter chart, and some of the results are you lose a turn.
Yeah,
and that's pretty much what I do.
When you're forcing your players to track things like provisions and water and et cetera, it's a real penalty. It stinks to lose a day.
Yep, and like in the time that I cursed the party, you know, they came this close to dying. It was almost a lethal result because of that.
Awesome. So when you're running outdoor spoliation and we have these caves with numbers on them, are those pre-populated or are you rolling them?
They are. Those are pre-populated.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Many of them were randomized prior to play. And then, you know, like we make a dungeon, and then I move stuff around to kind of make some themes or plots or links or stuff like that.
Yep. Yeah. And over the course of running that convention game, because I know that's sort of this weird halfway between a convention game and a campaign at this point, because you've run it for so many years running. Is the map now more densely populated than it was when you first ran it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. That's absolutely awesome. And like you say, I've had to work more stuff in to kind of keep the interest up, and it's gotten, and it's interesting because in some ways that has not always worked perfectly. Is the more you know, the first session I ran was the sketchiest thing I'd ever ran, and it worked very well. And sometimes the more detail that I put into it is actually fighting the overall flow of it. So I've made some mistakes about having overly detailed cave systems or overly detailed places that actually broke up the flow sometimes. So I'm kind of finding the balance there to not break the improvisational challenge of it.
Nice. I want to go back to one thing you said earlier, which was that you have to be higher level to go through a hex crawl. I think this is actually something that that BXD&D implies through the way it was published, and where they got it, I think, dead right, but maybe it isn't pointed out enough, right? Basically, the difference between the basic and the expert set. The basic set is supposed to cover levels 1 through 3. It's all about the dungeon. None of the wilderness stuff is in there. In the expert set, we get levels 4 to 13 or something like that, 14, and it adds in wilderness exploration. And that's about how I run it. If I was running a new campaign, or when I did first start my BX campaign, I started with, here's one town with a couple of dungeons very close by, some in town, some just like a day's journey away. I let the players play with that up until like level 3, 4, before I start saying like, okay, well, they've over the course of play, they keep hearing like, hey, there's a much bigger city to the north, maybe we should go visit that. And then we start to ease our way into... That's a very easy hex crawl because there's a road from here to there. You can't really get lost. It's a big landmark, but maybe some random stuff will happen to us along the way. And then I explode it out until they're doing full on crawling through the hexes.
That's a great point. And as usual, Moldvay and Cook with the B and the X set did a really good job of setting that up and clarifying that. You know, of course, the earlier Holmes basic set didn't have any wilderness stuff either, so it's kind of in the tradition. And it's one of those things where by an original D&D that was left implicit. It wasn't directly said, but the truth is if you look at the wandering monster tables and you look at the enormous armies that you're going to run into, the implication is that you have to be high level in order to manage or survive that. The truth is in my current campaign, I do soften that a little bit. By terrain location, I actually have dialed it down or customize it quite a bit so that my lower level characters can get around without getting massacred.
You know,
so I have massaged that a bit in my current campaign.
I have to point out that actually something that your outdoor spoliation games taught me that I had never really realized, or just never experienced, right, is that, yeah, a lot of these, like you look at the monster manual and you look at entries for any humanoid, evil humanoid race, it always gives their wilderness numbers, which is hundreds, right? Hundreds of goblins.
Yeah, usually like 30 to 300 usually, yeah.
Yeah, and I always thought, well, that's preposterous, right? And I never considered, like, a group of, I don't know, 5th, 6th level characters encountering 200 goblins is actually quite a fun encounter to play. And it turns out it is. It's crazy. It's really fun and ridiculous how having a high-level party face that many low-level opponents.
It is. It is. It's a crazy encounter when that happens. But we've run it many times, and it turns out to be, you know, a legitimate fight between mass, you know, area spells and multiple attacks from high level fighters. And someone usually has a bright idea to attempt to trigger morale checks. Right. You don't need to kill all 200 of them if you can make them run away before that. I have to really work actually to make those situations challenging for the players, because the high level versus giant mob thing is a, you know, legitimate fair fight, as we've discovered.
Yeah, I think that's really neat. If I could influence you a little bit, Dan, that might make a really interesting blog post of just, here are the mechanics of how one runs a group of 8 PCs at level 7 against a mob of 300 goblins.
It may require me to pretend that I know that answer better than I actually do.
Well, every time you've run it, it's been a blast. And I think you do a nice job of, like, layering in some Book of War stuff, and, you know, yep, there you go, Brian, beat me to the punch. Yep, yes, get Book of War.
Thank you for the compliment as someone who's played through it. And so among the things I didn't know the first time we played Outdoor Spoliation is I didn't know what direction that was going to go in. So I brought all my D&D books. I brought all my Outdoor Survival game. Yes, I brought the Book of War mass war game that I've got published on the website that you can see a link on from Wandering DMs. And I actually gave the players a starting amount of money that they could have hired an army if they'd wanted to. So I didn't know if they were going to go, well, we're going to take our dozen people and just charge in high level, or we're going to hire an army and start sacking castles. And I was like, I got to be ready for this. And what I didn't expect is we're not going to hire an army and we're going to sack some castles anyway was not the option I'd expected. But yes, I had Book of War at the table. They have, you know, sometimes the players have gotten a group of bandits to surrender to them, but to date they've never hired an army. So actually, yeah, I have Book of War. It hasn't actually been used, and they run up to a castle and I get fistfuls of D20s and I go, you're all being shot by 5 arrows and here come the fistful of D20s. And that's what's happened so far.
I think as a player, I think we always recognize that as cool as a giant army fight sounds, that the logistical nightmare of maintaining an army is not worth it. No one wants to spend half the game trying to figure out how do we feed these people? How do we convince them all to not run away? No thanks. All right, I think we should wrap things up here. Do you have any final thoughts, Dan, on hex crawls?
It's a deep subject, and we've been playing it for years, and I think that we discover more and more all the time. And I think if you go back to the claim that these are games where anything can happen, for me as a DM, it's been really interesting to take the sketchy rules in original D&D. Throw out a board and say to the players, you know, here's a goal, here's a specific goal, and for me, I set a money number, but anything can happen. You want to go at monsters in caves, you want to find treasure, you want to sack castles, you want to hire an army, you want to negotiate with people in the towns, it's all there for you, and then me as DM, I have to improvise the responses, because there's no way that I could possibly pre-plan for all that stuff, and we've learned more and more as we've done that over the years, and it's a fascinating challenge for both the players and the DM.
Yeah, I would I would reiterate what you said early, at the very beginning of this, of like how terrifying you thought it was to approach the table with so few notes. It is terrifying, but let me reassure you, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. You'll do fine. It's a super fun time, and it, honestly, that's one of the joys of it for me, is just how little extra like upfront work you have to do. You just have to be, you know, loose and go with the flow and sort of be ready for whatever crazy things the players do.
You know, I'll point out one thing that I think has helped both you and me, Paul, is there's an old product from Judges Guild called the Castle Guides, right? Is that what it's called?
Right.
Castle Guide 1, Castle Guide 2. It's clearly meant to tie into the original D&D castle rules. There's a lot of interfaces that it's clearly for that. And between the two books, there's like 100 different castles. It's available in PDF form on DriveThruRPG. And it does help me to just, I randomly roll D%, and this particular place is this particular castle, and I can show the players a map of this particular unique castle and then improvise everything else. And so just, again, having a visual aid to say, here is what you're looking at very quickly, that actually has helped quite a bit.
You know, there's a similar resource that I've not had a chance to use because I don't think it actually fits convention play. I would use this possibly for a campaign, which is Dice and Logos makes a booklet, half-size booklet called, I think it's just called Dyson's Delves, not to be confused with Dyson's Delve, which is a separate adventure. I know that's super confusing, but Dyson's Delves, basically it's a booklet where each page on the left side, there's a dozen or so room cave or dungeon or whatnot, and the right side is just lines. I always sort of wanted to use that for this style of play where the players go to a cave and I go flipping through the book and go, okay, that's what the interior of the cave looks like. Let's quickly populate it. Go.
And if you have, that makes sense. If you don't know who Dyson is, he's probably the current preeminent indie D&D map maker. I think his website's called Dyson's Dodecahedron. He has a Patreon, and he makes a new map every day, I think. So yeah. I'm linked to him on Facebook, and probably once, twice, three times a day, he's got new maps that he's turned out, and production is astounding, and it looks really nice, and he's spent a lot of time practicing his craft.
Yeah, I think I'm going to say this without checking, but I think that if you just go to DriveThruRPG and search for Dyson's Delves, you'll find those booklets.
Great. And you're talking about, again, you're talking about Dyson's Delves with a plural.
With a plural. It's two or three booklets he made. Each one is something like, 64 pages, right? Which just means it's got like 32 maps. I'm making numbers up that I might be totally wrong. Sorry, guys, if I got it wrong. But there's a really astounding number of maps in every booklet. And it's just real nice if you print them out, to have it in that format where you have a little booklet the same size as your little brown books and crack it open and have a map and a blank space to key it up real quick.
Yes. So I guess there's kind of a consistent theme to this discussion that having more visual aids for the players to interact with increases excitement, increases engagement. And that's kind of like we talked about last time, I think, with Tomb of Horrors, of wanting to use the illustrations for that same reason.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Just real quick, next week is a little unusual, or not next week, but next 2 weeks from now, it's a little unusual for us because Dan and I are going to be at a game convention. So we won't be doing our normal 1 o'clock, or maybe we will. Maybe.
We'll be on that afternoon. We're going to try to get on that afternoon sometime.
But we intend to try and do little smaller casts throughout the weekend live from the convention. The convention is TotalCon, which is in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Dan and I will be going. We'll be running some stuff. We'll be playing some stuff. I'm sure we'll have a lot of thoughts. And so hopefully maybe during meal breaks we'll bust out the camera and give a quick cast of what's going on. So watch the channel for that.
And in 1 week, more of Dan in Peru as I make from a recent trip in Peru as I wander around and make various DM rulings on random things that I run into and see. And that'll be happening alternate weekends for a month or two.
Awesome. So if you have any comments for us about hex crawls or any of the stuff we've been talking about in this video, please leave some comments for us below. We love seeing your comments, or if you have ideas for stuff you'd love to hear us talk about in the future, leave us some comments, and we will be happy to at least reply, and if not, possibly spin your suggestion off into an entire show.
And as always, please subscribe to the Wandering DMs channel on YouTube. That does help us out a lot. As Paul just said, we will be live in some form or another in 2 weeks when we're at TotalCon. So please come back and check that out for more provoking discussion. And we will talk to you next time.
See you next time.